You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe, Fred Nathan. He's founder and executive director of Think New Mexico. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you for having me.
So this is, it's such an interesting organization. You've been at it for what, 25 years or something?
20 years. Sometimes it feels like 25.
And it's literally a think tank. It's called Think New Mexico. But what you do is you basically take issues that you think need reform, legislative reform, government reform, and study them, analyze them, and then lobby for reform. And the thing that's scary about you guys is you always win.
Not always, but we've got a pretty good track record with the help of a lot of other people.
Yeah. And in the past, what are some of the issues that you've...
I think we're best known for getting a full-day kindergarten law through the legislature in 1999 to make full-day kindergarten accessible to every child in the state. And repealing the food tax is the other one that people seem to remember. But we've worked on a wide variety of issues. Many years ago, we created a strategic water reserve to keep some water in our rivers. We've worked on reforming the lottery to get more dollars for scholarship and less for administrative spending. And we created a healthcare transparency website a few years ago so that people know the cost of medical procedures at any one of our 44 hospitals before they have the procedure, which is more and more important with people having high deductibles.
And you also did some reform on the PRC, the Public Regulation Commission.
Correct. We got 3 constitutional amendments on the ballot, and we were delighted that all 3 passed. And they've had, I think, a positive impact on the PRC, and you know, getting the Department of Insurance out of there, I think, was a good thing. And now corporate reporting and some of those things have been consolidated over the Secretary of State. And we've raised the qualifications for commissioners, those people that serve on the PRC. It just used to be that you were 18 years of age at least and not a convicted felon and a residency requirement. And we just thought for people that are setting our electric rates and our phone rates and some other things that maybe they needed some more background and
that's a pretty low bar.
Yeah, very low bar.
Very interesting. So one of the things that I think is really important about what you guys do, and it's important in general, I mean, that phrase, and I've used it many times, the devil is in the details. So there's a lot of stuff that sort of conceptually sounds like a great idea, or let's do this, but whether an initiative is going to work or not really depends on details that are too wonky or nerdy for most people to really pay attention to. But you guys pay attention to them, and a lot of the benefits of that kind of policy and legislation that does the details right is invisible to the end user, so to speak, to the citizens.
Thank you for acknowledging that. Yes, we are policy wonks, and we do get our kicks from getting legislation written well and implemented correctly, and seeing the benefits for New Mexicans.
Today, what we're going to do is talk about your newest initiatives, which have to do with kind of broadly defined retirement in New Mexico. And retirement is something that, I mean, it's, you know, we live so much longer than we used to. So it's a real thing. And we also live in a time where older people, I mean, it can be an incredible time of life where, you know, you stop working and there's exploration and travel and so on. But for a lot of people, it's incredible vulnerability, not only because of illness and aging and so on, but because of poverty. A lot of people simply do not have enough when they retire. What does this look like in New Mexico?
So in New Mexico, and this is, I'm trying not to be too wonky here.
But, oh, go ahead.
But 62% of New Mexicans have nothing saved for their retirement. 80% have $10,000 or less. And that was a very astounding statistic that we came across, which is really what got us interested in this. And what I've discovered, and this is a misperception among, I think, most Americans, but also obviously a lot of New Mexicans, which is a lot of people think that Social Security is supposed to be their entire retirement. And it was really created as a supplement to keep the elderly out of poverty so they could live out their lives in dignity back in 1935. But fast forward to today, and I think many Americans think, I don't need to save for my retirement because I've got Social Security. And just to put this in context, the average benefit in New Mexico is about $13,900.
A year.
A year. And the Department of Labor says that the average elderly person in the United States needs about $28,000 to subsist for food, shelter, and so forth. So you see that there's a gap there that needs to be addressed.
There are so many variables, like the price of housing, which has gone up a lot here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and really over all over the country. There's almost no such thing as cheap rent anymore.
Right.
The price of food has stabilized. The price of energy is anybody's guess at this point. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if you were to say, what would be a kind of average number that somebody should have saved by the time they turn 65, given a life expectancy of, you know, 80 years or 85 years?
Well, it really depends on, I would say, every individual and, you know, what kind of lifestyle they want. But, you know, the bottom line again is that you can't, you know, and this is a wake-up call for the millennials, and I think something our generation, the baby boomers, really didn't learn was that Social Security, again, is just a supplement. It was never designed to pay for your entire retirement. And, you know, if you want a very basic, gross oversimplification, you should have at least as much private income as whatever it is that you're receiving from Social Security. And so, for example, in New Mexico, that would be at least enough money to generate about $14,000 a year.
So at a multiply minimum. That by,
yeah, I would
10
multiply
or 15
that,
years.
Yeah, I would multiply that by 20. So I would say that would be
$280,000.
About $300,000, $400,000 at a minimum, just to be able to live at subsistence with an average benefit from Social Security, which again is about $14,000.
So a lot of people in New Mexico are going into retirement without that, you know, safety net or savings. And you've got some initiatives that are designed to address that. And the first one is repealing the income tax on Social Security benefits. So this is kind of crazy. You pay all your life into Social Security if you have a regular job, and then you retire, you get that money, and then you're taxed on it. You got to give part of it back.
That's correct.
And which is kind of a double tax.
It is exactly a double tax, because people don't realize when you're paying into Social Security, you're taxed at that point. So you're taxed on the front end. And then in New Mexico, for the longest time, you weren't taxed on your benefits. And it really came about 29 years ago. At the end of a session, they had a $12 million deficit. And so they tucked into a very complicated tax bill on the second to last page, a single line saying, basically, going forward, we will tax you on your Social Security benefits. And of course, if you go back to 1935, when the Social Security Act was passed, it was never the intention that it was designed to subsidize state government. It was always designed, and it's been very successful, frankly. Back in 1935, about 50% of the elderly in this country were living in poverty. Today, that number in New Mexico is about 12.2%. So it's come down dramatically, and everybody attributes it to Social Security, which I think is why it's such a popular program. So it really doesn't make sense. It's counter to the intent of why the Congress and President Roosevelt created Social Security. And when you look around the country, 37 states have no tax on Social Security benefits. New Mexico, obviously one of only 13. And then of those 13, we have the second harshest tax on Social Security benefits. And as I said earlier, so many people are struggling to make ends meet. It seems sort of counterproductive to tax them twice on this. when they really need this money to subsist.
Now, how much does that tax amount to per year? I mean, does it make a really big difference if you repeal that tax?
Yeah, it's about $700 per beneficiary per year. And that's a lot of money, especially for people that are living from paycheck to paycheck or from beneficiary check to beneficiary check. And of course, that money would be put right back into the economy, restaurants and so forth, healthcare, just paying for their pharmaceuticals.
Right. Do Social Security benefits get taxed by the federal government as well?
They do.
Which was also probably counter to the intention.
Absolutely. So 1935, again, it wasn't taxed at the federal or state level. And then I think it was under President Reagan where there was a budget deficit that needed to be fixed. And so that's when they started taxing it very lightly at the federal level. And then we came around to New Mexico in 1990 and started taxing it a second time at the state level.
How are Social Security benefits distributed? I mean, I think it's if you make more money during your career, then you get more benefits.
Correct.
when you're retired, which, I mean, it seems kind of unfair to the people who made the least in the first place that they will have to continue to struggle when they're older.
Yeah, it's proportional to your income. So it goes up as high as, I believe, $45,000 is the most that anyone in the country gets as a yearly benefit.
I guess I find myself wondering why people get Social Security who don't need it, and then the people at the lowest levels don't get enough to live. And, you know, you say, oh, we should have, it should be a supplement. But as you say, many people are going into Social Security who haven't been able to save for whatever reason, and we'll get into that too. But, you know, somebody might be a millionaire, somebody might have saved $1 million over the course of their lifetime, which is not inconceivable if they invest it well and all of that.
Right.
And they're still getting Social Security.
You are right. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the Democratic senator from New York, was against means testing because he wanted the elderly to receive benefits, even though, as you point out, many of them don't need it, because he wanted to preserve the political viability of Social Security and have it supported by every element of society. So I think that's the short answer. And that philosophy has sort of prevailed. But I think your question's insightful in the sense that with the growing budget deficit in this country, we're going to have to adjust those benefits. And the obvious solution, I think, is to begin to means test Social Security, because we just don't have the luxury of paying millionaires Social Security benefits.
Means test means you wouldn't get it if you're wealthy, but you would get it if you're middle or poor, whatever.
Correct. Okay. So there'd be some, at some level, it would be cut off, and the government would simply say, you have enough to survive. Let's take this money and use it for low and middle income people who need it for their subsistence.
And someday we will do a show on the numbers of that, because that is, I mean, a lot of these social problems really boil down to math problems.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is, a lot of wealthy people, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett among them, not only don't think they should be receiving Social Security, but think that their estates should be taxed more. And more and more wealthy people are signing a pledge to ask to increase the estate tax. So I think eventually something will give there.
You have a second initiative. So the first one to help retirees here in New Mexico is to repeal the Social Security tax. Seems like kind of a no-brainer. The second initiative is to set up retirement plans for New Mexicans who aren't working for government. People who are working in government already have retirement plans set up. This would make them available to people in the private sector. Is that right?
Correct. And first of all, I wish, Mary Charlotte, you were in the legislature, because I love hearing you say that ending the double tax on Social Security is a no-brainer. We feel the same way. The second proposal has to do with the fact that only about 40% of private sector workers in New Mexico have access to a private retirement account. And this is something that I feel is also something of a no-brainer. Obviously, we'd like that number to be 100%. Relative to other states, unfortunately, we're last. But even the state that's first is not doing great. That would be Minnesota. And they're around 60% have access. But obviously, if Social Security isn't going to meet all the needs of people in their retirement, you're going to need to supplement that with some sort of private retirement savings. And a lot of small businesses in New Mexico just don't have the bandwidth. It's complicated to set up these plans. And this is a way to make it easier for businesses to provide this benefit to their employees and to have the government, in essence, like 529 plans, which is savings for college, create a plan that any employee can join. And all the employer has to do is sign up their employees for automatic payroll deduction. And this is the interesting area of this proposal. People are 15 times more likely to save if it's done through automatic payroll deduction. In effect, they don't even see the money.
Right.
And if you ask them to do it, they're very reluctant. People are very sort of status quo oriented. But if you sign them up and say, you have the option to opt out, they don't do that either. So it's sort of using this, I hesitate to use the word slacker, but this inclination to take the course of least resistance,
right,
and use that in a positive way to get people to start saving and supplementing what they're going to receive from Social Security by creating a private retirement account.
There's an analogy that I'm reminded of when you speak, which is that there are two countries in Europe that had organ donor programs, and one of them had very high subscription, one of them had very low. And it turned out that in one country, you had to opt out of being a donor, organ donor, and the other, you had to opt in. And the ones where you had to actually opt in and check a box had a much lower subscription.
There's some behavioral economists from the University of Chicago, I believe, Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler, who have documented this kind of behavior, and they call it nudge theory. And the idea is to use public policy or change our public policy to adapt to the way people behave around these big decisions. And I'm going to use that with donating your organs.
Yeah, I think it was Germany and Austria, two countries that are very culturally similar. And they were like, why is one so much greater than the other? But when it comes down to saving money for retirement, I mean, there's a couple of questions that arise for me. First of all, how many people in New Mexico are working minimum wage jobs? And if you have a minimum wage job, how can you really save for retirement? You're already in a continual state of struggling in debt.
Well, and this is the reason to give people the option to opt out. And I think those people who need to spend everything that they make just to get through the day are going to be the first people that would opt out. And I don't know that I don't have the exact figure off the top of my head as to what percentage of the population it is. If I were to guess, I would say it's about 20%. You know, people working in fast foods and so forth. But amazingly, there is some evidence that some of those people actually, I don't know how they do it, are saving for their retirement. You know, it's surprising, and wealthier people who have the ability to save in many cases don't. So it doesn't correlate as you might expect.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We'll be back in just a half a minute. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the Santa Fe Institute, a world-renowned research hub offering free online courses in the science of complex systems. Check out their community lecture series and summer science festival in Santa Fe. More at santafe.edu. Another question that arises is, for example, when I look at my own life, I think I took some kind of financial literacy course or whatever when I got out of college, and I was told that I should put money in an IRA every year. So since I was in my early or mid-20s, I've been putting in money in an IRA every single year. And I mean, anybody can do that, right? So when you say people don't have access to retirement savings, they technically they do, don't they?
Technically they do, but very few do what you've done. And usually it's provided through work, which makes it easy for people. They just have to check a box and they're given a form. And in this case, we want the company to provide automatic payroll deduction because that's really the most successful way to get people to save. And it's interesting what you were talking about, that you started very young. Because of the power of compounding, and this is where we get into the math, and Warren Buffett is a big proponent of this, is the money just compounds. The earlier you start to save, the better. And what happens in too many cases is people get to be my age, I'm 58, and they say, oh my God, I haven't saved for retirement. And then they try to do it, but they haven't had those 30 years of saving and compounding. So it's very difficult to catch up later in life if you don't begin saving earlier. And this is another reason to do this plan, which we call New Mexico Works and Saves, and make it as easy as possible for both employers and employees to create private retirement accounts.
Now, how does this apply, if it does, to people who are in the so-called gig economy, who are independent contractors, freelancers, and so on?
Makes it easier for them as well, because now all the paperwork and difficulty in creating these accounts is done by government, and all they have to do is sign up and create the automatic payroll deduction, which, you know, is relatively simple and hassle-free.
Are other states already doing something like this, and how's it going for them?
So this is a relatively new concept. The two states that are sort of in the vanguard here are Oregon and Maryland. And they just started this recently, so we don't have a long track record, but so far so good. They're signing people up, and they're finding that it's very popular both with businesses, employers, and employees. But we really don't have enough data yet to see the potential of this. But it reminds me a lot of the 529 plans that started sort of sporadically about 20 years ago. And then fast forward to today, and all 50 states offer this plan, which just makes it easier for parents to save for their children's college education.
When you pay into that, so your money is deducted, let's say you work for a company, it's deducted out of your paycheck, where does it go? Who looks after it?
So the way this law is going to work is it's going to be housed at the New Mexico Treasurer's Office, and they're going to contract, they're going to do a competitive bid with some of the mutual fund companies that you've heard of. Well, actually open to all of them. So Fidelity, Vanguard, Thornburg, those kinds of companies. And what I anticipate will happen is that they'll probably contract with multiple companies, and those companies will probably provide target retirement accounts. And what those are sort of a one-stop shopping for getting a fully diversified portfolio depending on your age. And recipients will just pay in, and those companies will be the stewards of that money, but it'll be overseen by the state treasurer's office.
Is that money tax deductible like an IRA? So you put in whatever, $1,000 a year?
Correct.
You can deduct that from your taxes?
Yeah, tax deferred, and you would hopefully only pay once you get to retirement age and start to take distributions.
So all of this, I mean, you were talking about making it as easy as possible for New Mexicans to sign up for this. So even if the, I mean, I think financial literacy is such an important thing. We don't learn this in school. We don't learn this in college. We have to seek it out when you're a young adult to even learn. A lot of people don't do that. Those courses aren't necessarily even readily available. How much do these initiatives depend on people understanding this stuff?
First of all, you're absolutely right. We should be teaching financial literacy in our public schools to every single child. And it can't start too early, actually. But the way we've patterned this is to assume that people don't have that financial literacy and just to make it as simple as possible for them to sign up.
So that when they turn 65, they'll go, wow, look at this.
Yeah, they've got a nice little nest egg, and it was good that they started when they were young and that it's compounded, and now it's over $300,000 or whatever that number is. And it's remarkable how little you need to pay in if you do it early enough with compounding, how that money can grow.
Even in these days of almost non-existent interest rates?
Well, if you're investing in just a CD, you're probably not going to grow it very much. But the stock market historically, on average, the indices have gone up with dividends about 10% a year. And so that can compound very fast. I won't go into the rule of 72 and some of these wonky math concepts, but it's...
Google it, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
So that's the second thing that you're doing. But there's another problem that we have here in New Mexico, which is that people who are in government and have pensions through the state of New Mexico, find themselves in a position where the state doesn't actually have money to cover the pensions that they are required by law to pay out to people who've been working for whatever, 25 years, for whatever institution it is in state government or in education, teaching, whatever. They don't have the money to pay these people. And it's bad. It's not like they have almost enough. It's what, 60% or something?
It depends which pension plan. We actually have some pension plans that are fully funded. In fact, they're overfunded. The best example being the pension for legislators, which is at 140%. And I believe there's one of the, maybe it's magistrate judges, it's about 130%. But you're absolutely right. For most public sector workers, their pension funds are between about 60 and 70%, which is much less than ideal. Interestingly, it doesn't need to be at 100% unless everybody's going to retire tomorrow and they have to pay it out. So 90% is considered safe. So we're below where we need to be substantially. And those are public pension funds. I think when you aggregate them together, the underfunding is something like $12.5 billion. So it's a very serious problem. But we should say that the legislature has implemented some reforms back in 2013 that have begun to kick in and are beginning to address the problem. More is needed to be done, and I'm heartened that Governor Lujan Grisham set up a task force that came up with some really good ideas that I think will be passed this session. But some of it's pretty controversial, and it involves cutting back some cost of living adjustments that are a little too generous or more than we can afford. So help is on the way.
Why are the pension funds underfunded in the first place? I mean, let's say I've been working for the state for 25 years. I pay in dutifully through my paycheck. Has that money been spent elsewhere? Or I mean, what's going on?
No, it's been spent on pensioners. We have in New Mexico one of the top three most generous pension plans in the country. So part of the problem was years and years ago, 30 years ago, these pension systems were very generous. And back then, we had very few recipients and many employees paying in. Fast forward to today, and you've got the opposite picture. We've got a lot of retirees and not that many employees supporting those retirees. So it wasn't very well planned. And unfortunately, these decisions, you know, you can't go back and fix them. You have to do it in today's dollars. And the can was kicked down the street, frankly, for decades. And it was predictable that we would get to this point. But thankfully, we've got some legislators and the governor who are trying to take some responsible actions to clean this up. And they've hit on some good ideas. We have some other ideas. We're going to focus just on one that we think is sort of low-lying fruit, which is to look at who's overseeing these investments. The PERA board, for example, they're not required to have any investment professionals at all on that board. And you look at some of the research around this, there was a wonderful study done by some researchers at Stanford who looked at all the public pension funds in the country and the qualifications of those on their board. And not surprisingly, the pension funds that are doing the most well are the ones that have qualified people on their boards. And then you have others like New Mexico, where there's no requirement that you have qualified people in finance and investment, where the returns haven't been as good.
I'm getting deja vu here. It sounds like the PRC.
It does sound like a lot like the PRC. You're exactly right. And so what we're going to propose is the obvious, which is let's upgrade the qualifications for those who serve. And essentially, there are no qualifications now, and we want to see that at least the majority of those who serve on the Public Employees Retirement Association board have some background in finance and investment.
So if that were passed, then there would have to be some turnover of the people who are on it and get people who, that's their profession, that's their professional qualification. You also have some other ideas of how this problem of the underfunding of the pension system could be addressed.
Yeah, and before I go to that, I should go back and talk a little bit, because I'm guessing most of your listeners probably aren't that aware of the PERA board, but it is, as the PRC was 10 years ago, famously, notoriously, you might say, dysfunctional. So for example, last year they had a meeting where they spent 7 minutes discussing snacks, the snacks that are provided to them at board meetings. And one PERA member was complaining about the lack of service that she was receiving from the staff of the PERA. So I think that's just sort of emblematic that they're really focused on the wrong things in many cases. And I don't want to disparage the entire board, but there's too many who really don't have a background and should be more focused on the $15.8 billion that they're investing on behalf of 90,000 retirees and not the quality of the snacks and how they're paid for.
One of the things that I've heard said is that in meetings of that kind, there's often an inverse relationship between the amount of time you spend talking about things and the importance of those things. So you might spend 45 minutes talking about the color of the new waste baskets in the office, and then 10 minutes talking about the budget.
That defines the PERA board. 2 days ago, they had a meeting to clean up some policies and procedures that the Attorney General and the New Mexico State Auditor were demanding be fixed, and they couldn't get a quorum. And in fact, one of the board members made a point of leaving so she could deny the body from getting a quorum. So this is seriously dysfunctional. This might even go beyond the PRC of 10 years ago in terms of the level of dysfunction. So it sound very important to change the qualifications for the PERA board, but it's actually almost an emergency, I would say.
I mean, these are the people who are overseeing your retirement money if you've been working for the state, and it's okay. So very important.
Yeah.
Change the qualifications. So is that a piece of legislation that's under consideration this session?
Yes. So George Munoz, senator from Gallup, who's the chair of the Investment, Pension, and Oversight Committee, is going to carry that himself, and we're working with him. So that bill, I think, will be introduced actually next week in the pre-filing. And we're hoping to get a message from the governor so that it will be germane to the session. And I think it's a very important, it doesn't sound particularly sexy and it's sort of wonky, admittedly, but it might be one of the more important bills when you think how much is at stake and how much these people are investing on behalf of 90,000 people, which is about 5% of the state and just about every government worker.
The devil is in the details.
Absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen. But you've got a couple of other recommendations as well.
Yeah. So another one is we have two essentially separate organizations managing investments for retirees. There's the Public Employees Retirement Association, which we've been discussing, and then there's the Educational Retirement Board, which serves public school teachers and university professors. And they've always conducted themselves as separate organizations, but we're wondering, looking out across the country, there are other states that are getting higher returns paying lower fees that have consolidated all of their pension funds into a single entity that manages all of them. And the reason this makes so much sense is, if you understand how Wall Street works, if you come to them with a larger investment, so for example, PERA and ERB are both investing in stocks and bonds, and if they go to a provider of investment services, they're likely to get lower fees if they provide more proceeds to be invested. And likewise, you tend to get better returns if you've got more to invest, because investment companies tend to put their best employees with their biggest clients. And so if you look at some of the states that have done this, Indiana, Florida come to mind, there are about six of them, they're seeing lower fees than we pay in New Mexico and higher performance. So the other thing that we'd like to see happen is to consolidate those two entities. That's going to take some time. That's not on the we don't have a bill this session. We think first we need to get more qualified people on those boards and then approach them about consolidation.
So you're talking about getting more qualified people on both of those boards.
Correct.
As part of this legislation in this
Yes.
session. You're also talking about, because there is this surplus because of the oil and gas production in southern New Mexico, taking a one-time lump sum and infusing that into the pension system.
Correct. That was one of our proposals in the report, and we were talking about, since the surplus this year is about $800 million, and we also have $2.3 billion in one-time monies that's been saved from previous years, taking a big chunk of that and actually loaning it to the PERA. And we were talking earlier about the power of compounding, giving it to them sort of like a 30-year mortgage, where they'd have that money to invest, but they'd have to pay back the principal to the state in about 30 years, when maybe oil and gas isn't producing as much and the state would need that money back. The other reason to make it a loan as opposed to just a gift is that we have to remember that a lot of taxpayers who are paying that money in, they don't have any retirement. And so there's really an equity issue, which is, should private sector employees that don't have a generous pension system be subsidizing state workers who have one of the most generous pensions in the country? So, but we were thinking that's a way to get them from where they are now, 60 or 70%, up to 90%, where they would keep all the income that they would make from investing, you know, $600 or $700 million without harming taxpayers who really can't afford to be subsidizing other pensions.
So we're talking about repealing Social Security tax. We're talking about making it easier for people to save for retirement. We're talking about having actual standards for qualifications for sitting on the boards of people who are taking care of retirement money for state employees. Is any of this partisan? I mean, do Democrats tend to, or do Republicans like or not like some of these things? Or is this really just like a humans in New Mexico thing?
You know, one of the reasons this is attractive to us as a nonpartisan organization is it does have crossover appeal, I think, both to Democrats and Republicans. Certainly in terms of upgrading the qualifications for the PERA board, I think that's long overdue, and both sides recognize that. On making retirement savings accessible to private sector employees, also very bipartisan. The one proposal, the repealing the double taxation of Social Security benefits, it's bipartisan in the sense that both sides agree. It's a question of how you do it. The Republicans that we've talked to would just like to repeal it altogether. The Democrats are more thoughtful in the sense that they'd like to repeal it first for low and middle income New Mexicans. They're really divided on wealthier New Mexicans. Some Democrats say, well, we really should repeal the whole thing because it's not fair to double tax anyone, even the wealthy. And then there's a significant number of Democrats that say, no, we need the money, so let's just exempt the first $24,000, for example, of Social Security benefits and not go all the way up to $45,000, which is the maximum people can receive. But on the whole, just to answer your question, I think all of these ideas have broad bipartisan support. The Social Security issue, again, because it's costly, to repeal the entire thing would be about $73 million. So that's going to be difficult to get across the finish line.
There's two things that I keep thinking about when I'm looking at the work that you're doing. And one of them is to contextualize all of this in terms of income inequality and wealth inequality in the United States. We have this sort of terrible kind of Gilded Age situation right now where the top 10% own a huge proportion of the wealth and get a huge proportion of the income. I don't know what the exact numbers are. And so, you know, the rest of us on some level are scrambling for the crumbs. And does any of the work you're doing address that?
I would say that that second proposal about making private retirement accounts more accessible to private sector workers is going to be hugely beneficial to low and middle income people and help to, you know, what you're talking about, and it's a great question, is a ginormous problem. The wealth inequities in our society. And there's no one sort of policy prescription, but I think we need to do probably lots of different things. And I think getting middle income and low income people saving for their retirement earlier and making it easier is part of the solution.
The other thing that comes to mind is this sort of bind that we're all in, which is, on the one hand, we're dependent on oil and gas money in a very large way to balance the budget of the state, to have surpluses, and those surpluses go to all kinds of things like education and retirement and so on. And this oil and gas is going to be burned and go into the air and make climate change even worse than it already is. And that directly affects the quality of life and the economy of New Mexico in the long run. So we're in a very bad catch-22. And if you look at capitalism overall and the way that, you know, extractive industries are really extracting the living heck out of the earth, the air, the land, human capital, I mean, it's a very sick and toxic system. And yet, we are investing in it in order to have retirements where we're not poor. I mean, these are really big catch-22s that we're all in.
Well, yeah, these are big questions. I'm not sure I have the answers to them. But, you know, I think both sides of the aisle are talking about the need to diversify our economy away from oil and gas. So first of all, we're not so dependent on it. And eventually, it will peter out. I mean, these are resources that are finite. So it's going to, that part of it's going to take care of itself. People argue about when that's going to happen, whether it's, you know, if we're at peak oil now, or if that's 20 years or 50 years from now. But I think everybody, whatever your position is on this, should agree that we need to diversify our economy away from oil and gas and grow other industries.
Anything else that you want to let people know about, especially before the legislative session starts in January?
Well, if people want to get involved on these issues around retirement security, I would encourage them to go to our website, specifically to the Action Center. And it makes it very easy to contact your legislators. And we've got pre-scripted letters that they can send. And we always encourage people to edit those emails that they send to their state senator and state representative. You don't actually even need to know who they are. If you type in your address, the computer will automatically send it to your state rep and your state senator and the governor. And the way to get there is to go to our website at thinknewmexico, written out as one word, .org.
thinknewmexico.org. Fred Nathan is the founder and executive director. Thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you for having me again. I really appreciate it.
That's our program today, and we want to thank our sponsors, the Lenzig Performing Arts Center, the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, the Southwest Care Center, the Lannan Foundation, and the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks so much for making this program possible. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lano Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.